At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And today I've got the guy that The Rock used to call Hermie. Yeah, you'll find out why. Just one of the great stories that Kevin Kelly is sharing here on Talk is Jericho. Former WWE announcer, current New Japan pro wrestling announcer. He's talking all about his run at WWE, including his initial audition with Jim Ross, his first face-to-face meeting with Vince McMahon, working closely with Gorilla Monsoon, and Kevin was at Brian Pillman's house the night Stone Cold Steve Austin came knocking and gunshots rang out. Kevin shares what happened behind the scenes with that USA Network angle and what he actually knew about it going in. There's a lot of controversy at the time. Kevin was also there for the Monday Night Wars and remembers exactly what happened that started to turn the tides in WWE's favor. And of course, Kevin is going to be talking all about announcing for New Japan Pro Wrestling, a lot about the company, the culture, the New Japan style, how he ended up in Japan in the first place, what he thinks of Don Callis. A great conversation with Kevin Kelly starting now on Talk is Jericho. All right, so it's been a long time since I saw you last, Kevin Kelly.
I know.
I saw you the other day at the press conference.
Created quite a scene
in Tokyo. A little bit of a scene.
Very proud of you.
Yeah. But before that, maybe 12 years, 13 years?
I left WWE in 2003.
Good enough. Really?
So, yeah.
Jeez, man.
Yeah.
It's pretty rare, like, when you see a guy like yourself and then Don Callis, you guys are doing a great job commentating for New Japan. And Don's the same. Been in the business since, like, 90 and then had disappeared for a while and came back. Did you stay in the business all the way through from 2003 to now?
Pretty much. After I left WWE, I needed to get a real job because opportunities in the industry, there weren't any anymore.
Right.
You know,
right.
I got let go. I came home. I called Jeff Jarrett.
Oh, okay.
And Jeff said, I'd love to have you. I don't have any money.
Right.
but we'll see if anything changes. And nothing ever changed.
Mm-hmm.
So was just banging out resumes just for voiceover work, for acting, for sports, for anything. Getting nowhere. And then I tweaked my resume. Wrestling is sales. And I knew I could sell because I'd been in wrestling.
Right.
So I was fine with getting a sales job. So the same resume I had been sending out for 11 months and had gotten no interviews or nothing, I changed all the wording to sales. I got 5 interviews in a week.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to be a salesman, honey.
But there's that stigma against wrestling, right? Like you said, it's either at the time it's WWE or TNA. And then you're done.
That's it.
Those are your options.
Yeah, and there was no streaming services, so company, there was not a High Spots Wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody that had their own, you know, whether it was Twitch or whatever app they were using. Fight TV didn't exist. So the avenues were limited. But it was great because I learned sales and I learned how to sell. And selling made me a better broadcaster because I got into radio sales, selling radio airtime.
Mm-hmm.
And I would pull up to a business with a business card in my hand, and I would think in my mind like a creative pitch. I'd walk in and I would say, hey, here's my business card. I'm from WSBG down the street, sitting in the parking lot looking at your sign, and I came up with an idea. And I would pitch him like an open to a show.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same thing I had done in wrestling 1,000 times. Mm. And I would get them interested.
Mm.
And that was how I I didn't sell the numbers. I didn't sell reach and all that frequency. No, I sold emotion, which is what we do in wrestling. Same thing.
Like you said, especially as a commentator, because it's so important. And I've talked to Don about this and Mark Madden and a few other guys. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the secret to being a good commentator? What's your job when you sit down behind the desk at the beginning of a show?
Play-by-play guy is to keep the boat going straight and always putting the emphasis on the ring. Give every match a reason for being in the ring and making sure that you're telling that story all the way through. Hmm. Always getting back to the first thing that I said while they're circling before they lock up. This is why this match is happening. I learned that from Jim Ross.
Hmm.
Give every match a reason for being in the ring before they lock up.
Did you commentate with Jim?
He was part of my audition, actually.
Tell us about it.
So I get an audition through Billy Gunn. He and I were friends from Florida. We broke in together. They were coming down for a run of house shows when he was still in the Smoking Guns. Hey, if they need a local ring announcer, I'm always available.
Is that what you were doing, local ring announcer?
Yeah, I lived in Florida at the time, and so he and I were always buddies. He said, I'll check, I'll find out. So I coincidentally got an audition with WCW at the time. Hmm. So those MGM tapings where they would bring all the tourists in?
Yeah.
I was the guy that was behind the camera telling them when to cheer and when to boo.
What year was that?
95.
Oh my gosh, I was there in 96. Yeah. Like you said, they would put like a thumbs up, make sure you cheer, thumbs down, make sure you boo.
I was getting the disco sucks chant, which was actually really easy for disco. Even the international fans who had never seen wrestling before hated him. And it's like they knew him.
It's just the way, just got the air about him. So what would you have to do? You'd stand behind the camera and do what?
Yeah, just hold up a sign that said, I'm giving the thumbs up, or hold up a sign or whatever. I'd lead the clap on the comeback. It was fun.
So you weren't actually working for WCW. No, you were working more for Universal.
It was an audition through them. Okay. And I talked with Eric and I talked with Tony Schiavone and they didn't have much interest. But anyway, while I was there, Billy Gunn paged me. That's how long ago this was. I had my pager. I go to the payphone. I call him. I'm in between shows. Hey, man, what's up? You need to call Bruce Pritchard right now. What? Yeah, they want to bring you up. I'm thinking immediately. Oh, good. Ring announcing. No, they want to bring you up for an audition. To ring announce? No, announcer. Okay, he gives me the number. I call Bruce. Kevin, what are you doing? I'm in between shows at WCW. You haven't signed a contract, have you? No, they haven't offered one. Oh, okay. How are the shows? Kind of the shits. All right, good. Well, we want to bring you up for an audition. So I did. And Jim Ross was the guy who was the heel wrestler when I did the interviews. He was wrestling Shawn Michaels at MSG. And then we sat down and did commentary together. And I thought I did terrible. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my gosh. It was Bruce and a woman from HR and Kevin Dunn. They were the three-person panel. So I get done with the audition. I open up the door, and there's the woman from HR. She hands me a Monday Night Raw t-shirt. I'm like, oh, this is the consolation prize. In the car, back to Newark, and the driver gets a call. And he says, hey, they want you back. Okay, so he U-turns on 95, and we go back up to the office. And they said, we had everybody here today, and we decided we want you to be the one to meet Vince. Sweet. So I'm upstairs in the conference room waiting to meet Vince. Nervous. Don't know what I'm going to say. I have no idea what I said, Chris. I probably threw up on him. I have no idea. And somehow I got the job.
Such an intimidating guy when you first meet him, right?
God, yeah.
Was it in his office, too?
In a little conference room down the hall. And I'm scrambling, trying to, what am I going to say? And this was right after Nash and Hall had just left. Raw magazine sitting there. I'm flipping through. And there was a line about loyalty. So I talked about loyalty in there. And I said, hey, whatever happens, I will always be loyal to you. Mm-hmm. And I always was.
Yeah. So you start off doing commentary on...
Yes, syndicated shows.
Right.
International syndicated, worked with Gorilla Monsoon a lot, worked a little bit with Ray Rougeau.
Tell about Gorilla, what was he like?
Monsoon was great. Everybody at the TV studio loved him. He was not the same, though, when I met him, because when his son Joey Morella passed away.
He was never the same after that. Right?
Everybody said, oh, if you would have known Gino back in the day, God, he was... so he was a little... But he still had... that wit and that just sarcastic, biting nature, but he was super nice. And it was great. We were actually, I had to tell him, he didn't know this, we were actually related by marriage.
Really?
My great uncle married his sister-in-law.
Was he like still announcing at that time in 95?
Just a little bit, just on the syndicateds. He would drive up once a week from Jersey. He would go into Kevin Dunn's office. They would talk about gambling, and then he would come downstairs and do voiceovers and then go home.
Because I think he was one of those guys like Skoland and a couple of the guys that was,
yeah.
Wasn't that kind of the story that Vince's dad, when he bought the company or when Vince Jr. bought the company, that he had to take care of these other guys that were investors at the time?
Right.
Right.
And he was, Monsoon was part of the Capitol Wrestling in Washington.
Yes, right.
So he was part of the fabric of the company and was never going to go anywhere. I had a job for life. And there were a few guys like that. The older class, when you came in, a lot of those guys were starting to be gone, but that older class of road agents, I was like, why are they all still here?
Jack Lanza.
Lanza was really good.
I think Sergeant Slaughter might have been there.
The one I always questioned was Strongbow. Like, Strongbow didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But he still had a job. So it was just always in the back of my mind. I was like, this must be one of those legacy guys that had to stick around.
Vince was loyal to all those guys.
He was loyal to everybody. There was a story I've told before. Perfect and I worked together a lot. And we were in Knoxville for TV. So we get in the rental car, drive to the building. And he said, oh, man, I went and saw Mr. Fuji this morning. Oh, my God. Fuji lived in Knoxville.
Yeah.
I said, what happened? He said, oh, he's in bad shape. He's bad health. He can't walk. He's tearing tickets at a movie theater. It breaks my heart. We get to the building. The first person we see is Dave Hebner. He says, hey, Heb, I saw Fuji today. He says, oh, what? Tells him the same story. When's the production meeting? 20 minutes. Well, let's go talk to Vince. Two of them went to Vince's office. Production meeting happens, finishes. Then I see Perfect at lunch. He says, you're not going to believe this, Kevin. I went in the office, told Vince the same story I told you. Vince got 10 grand cash, put it in an envelope, and said, take this to Fuji.
Oh, wow.
Nobody ever knew.
That's cool.
And that's the type of guy that he
is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. People don't know that about
right.
him, you know?
Right.
Even when we're here in Japan doing this Tokyo Dome show, I called him as soon as the deal was done. He was so, like I say, he was excited about it, but he was excited about it. He was like, that's great. He understands that it's good for the business, good for me, and good for him.
Right.
You know, it's like a lot of people think he's like this fire-breathing tyrant, but that's not the case.
No,
in a lot of cases, you know?
I always had a really good relationship with him. Mm-hmm. I never had a cross word with him. You know, the reputation that he always screams at the announcers?
In your ear?
In your ear while you're sitting there doing commentary live, Sunday Night Heat. I did a few Raw episodes live, and then they wanted to get JR and the King as a solo team, and they eventually put myself, Michael Cole, and JR as a three-man team on the first hour.
Really?
Yeah.
And then you would leave after the first hour?
After the first hour, then Lawler would come out, and because at the time, for ratings, they were trying to do WWF Raw from 9 to 10.
Yes.
And Raw's War from 10 to 9.
They would always like have like a closing credit at the end of the first hour, and then an opening credit, even just a little graphic, right?
Yeah. And that was just for that. But so it was, you know, so sitting there and listening to Vince, I didn't take all of his advice. Sometimes he would feed me a line and it wouldn't fit because the moment had already passed.
Right.
And I did hear a couple of say-its, but not like screaming and yelling.
Mm-hmm.
He was always really good. One time, I forget what a pay-per-view it was, but Sunday Night Heat, I think we were in Vancouver, and places sold out, and I was fired up, shot out of a cannon. I'm screaming right off the bat, and Vince, as soon as I finished, and whoever I was working with started, he goes, take a breath and relax. It's an hour-long show.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay.
Right.
So it was, but that's the type. So he has that reputation that we all know and read about, but there is much more to the story.
But that was also kind of a transitional phase for the company. If you're talking about 95 leading into like the Monday Night Wars,
right,
which really started about 96, like you said, when Hall and Nash left. So what was it like in the company at the time?
They were having profit improvability meetings.
Profit and what does that mean?
That means we're losing money.
Oh, wow.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
And we need to stop losing money. So anybody have any ideas?
Mm.
And it was, you know, sharpen pencils all the way down, turn off lights when you leave a room.
Really?
Yeah, it was tough. And it was the first year that they had a profit sharing plan. The company wasn't public at this point, but since Vince and Linda owned it, they would do profit sharing with the employees. And 96 was the first year in a long time that they got zero because they lost $6 million.
Wow.
So there were no profits.
I remember hearing at the time that they did a Madison Square Garden show, and they were excited because they hit like 100 grand.
Yeah.
Which at the Garden, like you hit 100 grand like in frickin' Ithaca.
Yeah.
On a Sunday afternoon. 100 grand at the Garden, that's terrible. But at the time, they were like excited.
Yeah. Business was starting to pick up. after I had started. And because I started the, so Austin 316 says, I just whooped your ass June 23rd, 96. I start June 24th,
okay.
96. I take credit for the whole episode. You're welcome. But so those emails are starting to come out. Hey, we had a great house in Pittsburgh, 125,000. Mm. And those numbers are starting to come up. And Vince Russo said to me, man, I don't know if they should be sending those out because those numbers go up and they come down. I doubt they'll be sending those emails if right. if we don't keep doing good.
So is that how it is when you're a commentator? You're kind of almost in the office as well to get those type of emails? Because the boys aren't getting those type
right.
of emails.
It was after my first year, they wanted, Kevin Dunn never liked me for whatever reason. And he wanted to let me go. So he calls Vince McMahon at his house, and Vince Russo was there writing TV at the time with him, and they're on speaker. Kevin Kelly's contract's up. I'm going to let him go because I only had a 1-year contract.
Right.
Okay, no problem. But wait, why? And Vince kind of looks down his glasses. So why, pal? And Kevin Dunn says, whatever. Vince Russo says, well, he's shown an interest in writing. Can I have him? Oh, yeah, you certainly can have him. Well, I got to go, guys. Thanks so much. Couldn't get off the phone fast enough.
Really?
So now I work for Vince Russo.
Okay.
Just transitioned over to the office and started helping with the magazines and helping with the AOL site and the WWF.com. And it's
Bite This.
Yeah, Bite Through and Bite This later on. And then eventually they had the idea for the 3-man team. So I got brought back to TV, but I still had my magazine responsibilities.
So you're actually writing for WWE Magazine?
Yep.
But not writing the shows?
Not writing the shows. Mm-hmm. I was just a creative guy on the magazine end. They gave me the title managing editor, which I still have no idea what that is.
And looks good on a business card.
I wrote, like, you know, so there would be a lot of material in the magazine that didn't have a byline. That was me, that was Bill Banks, that was Vince Russo, whomever.
Right.
We were all just writing this stuff. And you know, occasionally would chime in with Vince Russo and he'd be looking for a creative idea and a couple of us would throw some ideas around. We went to lunch one day and he's like, I'm stuck for a main event. This is right after Austin wins the belt. And I remembered Vince, instead of, because they used to do the thing where the champion wins the belt at the pay-per-view and the Monday Night Raw after that, he would be there to present the title to the new champion, symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Austin won, and he and I had done the interview before where I said, do you want Stone Cold Steve Austin to win, yes or no, trying to pin him on the spot, he says, not just no, it's hell no. Austin wins, Vince comes down, he's wearing the belt around his waist. Odd. So anyway, I said to Russo, I remember Vince wearing that belt around his waist when he came down to give it to Austin. If I'm Steve Austin, that's going to piss me off. So he had been talking about a corporate champion. You want a corporate champion, Vince? I think what you're saying is that you want to be the champion, that you think you're the corporate champion. So we'll do it this way, the easy way or the hard way. Easy way is you face me tonight for the WWF championship. Hard way is I come back there and I beat your ass right now. And so sure enough, the match is made. So I tell this to Russo and he's like, that's crazy, but I'll pitch it. And he went upstairs to Vince's office and he pitched it, and that's what they did. So it was a real open submission kind of thing. There weren't a bunch of writers. It's
amazing how that's changed, hasn't it?
Like, yeah.
I started there in 99 and my big famous debut promo, which I watch now and it's like, my opinion doesn't matter, but people say it's classic. I wrote the whole thing myself.
Wow.
No rehearsal. I went over it with Russo and Rock, but Vince didn't know. It's like now everything is so meticulously detailed, yeah, and gone through the ringer and approved and reapproved and rewritten. Wasn't the case back at that time. It was only 20 years ago.
And your promo still holds up.
Right.
It still holds up today.
Mm.
And I think that, again, you know, is one of the things that is lacking today in character development. Why aren't the guys connecting with the audience? Because it isn't them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Miz is great because he takes the written word and he makes it Miz.
Yeah.
And it's him saying it, but the writers feel him and they know him. Somebody new coming out of the shoot, man, I don't know if the case would have been the same. Here's Chris Jericho. People like him. They know him. They saw the vignettes. What are we going to say about him? Well, here, Chris, here's your words.
Right.
Wait, I wouldn't say that.
Until you get that, I guess, respect or that trust where you can change it on your own.
Yeah.
But that takes a long time. You know, most guys don't have that. So like you said, read it. This is the way it's written. Don't deviate. This is approved. I used to get all the time. This is approved by Vince. And I'd be like, I haven't even read it yet. How can it's not approved by me.
Right.
Well, we'll go through it. Like, no, this is not right. But other guys don't really have that freedom.
Yeah. And, you know? And that's where, and so I do a lot of camps around the country at wrestling schools and
like seminars and stuff.
I do a lot of seminars. And I emphasize sales. You're all in sales now. You hate salesmen, but guess what? You're a salesman. So be a good salesman.
Mm.
And sell with emotion. Don't give them a bunch of words. Don't just give them stats and speeds and feeds. Give them emotion. Make them care. Connect with the audience. And that'll transition to what you do in the ring. Move less, sell more. Mm-hmm. And I say, listen, only in WWE is somebody going to hand you a piece of paper with your words on it. So everywhere else, you have to know you. Mm. And when you get there and you get good enough, you still have to know you so that you can say, you know what? I've gotten to a certain level here. I think I know me well enough to be able to tell writers or Vince or whomever, I wouldn't say it that way. Here's what I would say.
Right.
But you have to know you.
It's interesting. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
You know, like they would say, no one knows better what your character is going to be other than the guy himself.
Right.
Or yourself.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
I remember you doing a lot of like, am I mistaken, like backstage interviews and stuff?
That's what I mostly did.
That's kind of what you moved into that position on.
Right.
Yeah.
I still did Heat. I still did like syndicated shows. I did hundreds and hundreds of episodes of syndicated shows, but mostly was the backstage interview guy on the live Raw and the tape SmackDown.
So what did you see that kind of started changing the company's fortunes to start increasing and getting more popular and eventually beating WCW?
It was all started at the TV studio. The TV studio knew that the look and the feel of the show needed to change, and that's when the transition in 97 to Raw's War began. Different look, different feel, big stage, Titantron, et cetera, et cetera. And let's create an adversarial atmosphere where we know these guys in Atlanta are trying to put us out of business. Let's go to war with them. Mm-hmm. And so that's what they did. That was Dave Sahadi and Chris Chambers. And
man, Dave Sahadi, yeah.
Yeah, all of them sort of leading that charge. And that was where it began. And then the talent roster started to turn over and more guys started to come in. And things started, ratings move at a glacial pace. So it took a long time for the better program, as we all felt, to eventually get over. But, you know, when Mike Tyson gets in the ring with Steve Austin, that helped. Everything helped. It was all incremental. There was not one event that you can say, well, this was the turning point.
Okay.
It was a gradual progression, but it was staying with it. Mm. It wasn't easy. There were, I think in 96, 97, even though they had made it was 96. One of the things that led to the Raw's War, they were doing like, they had sent a crew to Kuwait, and they had some TV there, and it was terrible, and the ratings came out, it got like a 1.7. It was awful. And Vince had a meeting that he pulled a bunch of people, Pat and JR and Bruce and Cornette and Vince Russo, and was like, guys, we need a change. What are we going to do? We need something. And it was a bunch of non-answers. Russo told me this story, so I put that caveat on it, and he pulled out Raw Magazine and said, this is what we should do. We should have this kind of attitude, this, you know, break down the fourth wall, whatever, whatever.
Just, that's what you were doing in the magazine at that point.
Just shoot with the fans. We had WWF Magazine and we had Raw Magazine. WWF Magazine was still family friendly, whatever, whatever. Raw Magazine was, this is the shoot. This is the real stuff. And Vince looked at it and he was like, okay. And then started encouraging Russo to attend more of the meetings. And he was instrumental in putting forth a lot of those things. And then after a while, it was Vince and Ed Ferrara and Vince McMahon writing TV.
And
that was when it really started to kind of take off. It was, you know, good and bad. You watch back some of those shows now and it's like, ugh, God, what, Jesus.
It's so funny though, the thing like magazines, like the most archaic of tools.
Right.
Which were so important at the time.
Sure.
You know, and now it's like, you think like a magazine, like, wow.
We got in trouble because at the time they were having like Dory Funk had camps, a Funkin' Dojo,
yeah,
and invited, you know, some indie guys and some guys that were, they were trying to figure out what to do creatively to work out with Dory and do a bunch of stuff. And Dr. Tom was there and we had put a write-up about this. It's just a small one page thing. And it had a picture of Adam Copeland and Sean Morley. And I can't remember who else, maybe Jay was there, mm-hmm. But Vince saw it while he was driving somewhere and calls up Vince Russo screaming, what the hell is this? I want this magazine pulled off the stands right now. He flipped his lid because he didn't want those guys to be seen as themselves. He wanted to wait until somebody would come up with creative ideas for them.
Really?
But all we were doing, we were just shooting with it. Hey, right. These guys were here. This was a factual news story. Here's what they did. It was a recap of the camp.
But for Vince to flip out on that says that there's probably a big circulation for the magazine at that point.
There
then.
Was. But again, Vince would go back and forth between, yes, 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 this is what we need to do. We need to open, you know, and then all of a sudden he changes his mind.
He has a penchant for changing his mind.
Yes,
yeah.
as he's wanted
as
to do.
As we know, right?
But so I go down the hall to the guy who was responsible for the press runs of the magazine. And I said, hey, we just got a call from Vince McMahon. He's really pissed off about Raw magazine. What can we do about it? He says, it's already in circulation. I said, can we pull it off the newsstands? No.
Yeah.
How would we do that? No, it's already done. Okay. So we did nothing. And we didn't report back to Vince or anything. And it was forgotten about. He never asked about it again.
That's when you walk from newsstand to newsstand, just tear out that page.
Yeah. Wait a minute. What are you doing? I'm running down the street.
But that's, once again, typical Vince. Like, the next day, probably didn't even think about it ever again. That's always the rule. Like, if you ever have a match or something where Vince flips out on you, take your medicine and then just never mention it again. The next day, don't say a word about it because he's moved on.
Yeah.
You know?
What I always wanted to ask you, when you walked down the stairs at the Rosemont Horizon after you killed that first promo, what were you thinking? You killed that promo and you come down the steps of the gorilla position right to the backstage area.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're walking down the steps, did you think like you killed it? Were you happy with it?
I don't remember. I remember like being super excited beforehand, like when my name flashed on the Tron and everyone went nuts.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, like people actually know who I am. Because you never know for sure.
Yeah.
Like, are people paying attention or do they even watch WCW? And if they did I make that type of a mark on them, an impression? So I remember before just the reaction. I just thought was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, I don't really recall too much of a response or a pat on the back, which is quite typical.
Right.
But I remember this was in the infancy of the internet, and somewhere was posted online, as you know, that where there's smoke, there's fire, mm-hmm. that Vince did not like the promo because he didn't like my facials.
Hmm.
And he said they were too cartoonish. And when you watch it back, they were a little bit Popeye. And of course, no one told me that. But reading it, I was like, how the hell how do they find this shit out? And then I watch it back. I'm like, it's probably true because I know how Vince thinks. And he's like, oh, look at this guy. He's a cartoon character. But you didn't know that stuff coming from WCW
right.
to WWE. It was two different worlds. And I was just playing the same character that I played there, just trying to get some TV time and get some steam. But so that's what I remember the most was like maybe the next day reading that. And like, ish, I guess he didn't like it.
It was such a great thing. And I felt, because when you had asked me to do this interview, and I'm really thankful for being able to be a part
Thanks,
of it,
man, yeah.
I was thinking back to that promo and the sense of pride that the guys at the TV studio
really
felt about that.
How do you mean?
The reaction that you got was validation for all the work that they had put in on the countdown of the millennium.
Gotcha.
And that when their ideas came, again, they're uncredited.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the validation that they get.
Right.
Is that when you come out and you get that response, they're like, hell yes, everything that we did was right.
It's a great point because David Sahadi and then, of course, Adam Panucci.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we ever really discussed those names on any of my shows before, but they're the backstage guys that would make all the intro clips, the vignettes. You know, for me, like the break the walls down with the cityscape and the chick dancing and all that stuff. That's not just random. That's very meticulously put together. For me, it was always Adam Panucci, but David Sahadi was very involved in that as well.
Right. The whole team in that promos department, David Sahadi, Chris Chambers.
Chambers as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Barry Bross, Doug Adam, all those guys.
What's his name? Doug LeBeau.
LeBeau.
Yeah.
But it was just validation for them. And I know how the TV studio cared so much. And the word was always, they kind of look down their nose at wrestling. No, they don't. Mm. They appreciate it. They come in from school or from sports, and they may not know it, but, man, they glom onto it, and they grow to love it.
Well, it's like you said. I mean, the production of WWE, and even if you're not a wrestling fan, it's better than NFL,
right,
in a lot of ways. I mean, it really is. It's so slick. And I think you take it for granted almost at watching, let's say, Monday Night Raw. You see how it's produced and how it's done. It's like, dude, no one else does that in showbiz.
Kerwin Silfies has been the director. I don't think he's director anymore, but was the director for 1,000 years.
He's still there.
Yeah. And he was responsible for lighting the crowd in that certain way by using those cans to come off the truss and to shoot beams of light onto the audience. That was not being done. But that has been copied now by everybody.
Right.
Just in all sports, in basketball, in everything. And that's one of those innovations that, you know, came from wrestling. Mm-hmm. You know, the XFL with the sky cam.
But just thinking that, the camera that went over the field, yeah, that's totally XFL's right. idea.
And,
yeah.
And now that's...
Reporters in the locker room, yeah, that sort of stuff.
There was always that type of thing. So yeah, WWE does not get enough credit for the innovation.
The production standpoint.
Right.
Talk about when you were a backstage interviewer. What were some of your highlights of stuff that happened? Because I seem to remember you did a lot of stuff with The Rock.
A lot of stuff with, yeah, The Rock.
And what did he call you? Hermaphrodite?
Yeah.
How did he call you? Hermaphrodite?
That was a Brian Gewirtz idea. Gewirtz pitched it to me, and the way he said it, it was like really condescending and shitty, and I wanted to punch him. But then when I talked with Rock about it, I said, listen, I'll do anything you want. You know, are you cool with this? He says, yeah, we'll make it funny. I said, okay, as long as you're cool with it. He and I knew each other in Florida.
Oh, okay.
Before he started in wrestling, he was still playing at the University of Miami. And I was ring announcing on a bunch of local shows down there trying to get noticed. And I had the chance to work with Cuban Assassin, who was booking this little show, these run of shows in this one little town north of Tampa. And they let me sit in on the finish meeting. So it's him and Ned Brady and me sitting there. And he's like, okay, in the main event, I think it was either Cuban or Ned against Rocky Johnson. So when the time is right, we'll hit the ring and bop, 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 boom, boom, DQ. Okay. And then Rocky pops in. Oh, yeah, good time. We were just talking about your match. And he explains the finish. And he says, hey, I got my kid here tonight. Is it okay if he comes down and makes the save? Yeah, sure, whatever. Then match finished just the way they said. Here he comes in his number 94 University of Miami jersey. Slides in the ring. Dwayne Johnson throws those same signature punches that he did, even though he hadn't started training yet. And father and son stand shoulder to shoulder and the heels retreat.
That's great.
Yeah.
What a story.
And yeah. I always would laugh with him. I'd be like, hey, listen, Rock, I can make some calls if it's not working out here for you. Get us back in that flea market in Hudson. He's like, oh, yeah, man, that would be awesome. But we were always cool. So we knew each other. I did the interviews with him when he first came up as Rocky Maivia. You know, we talked a lot of trash because I'm an FSU guy. I graduated from Florida State and he's from Miami. So...
What was the hermaphrodite thing? Why did he call you that?
Because they said I had equally working parts of male and female genitalia. I don't. But
the textbook definition of a hermaphrodite.
Yes, that's what it is.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that was written out of some sort of evil spite, but we turned it into fun. And my idea was every time I'm going to put that microphone in front of the Rock's face, I'm waiting for that validation. Mm-hmm. That was my motivation. Mm-hmm. Today's the day where I'm going to ask a great question. He's going to say, you're a hell of a reporter, Kevin Kelly. And then he's going to tell us.
But you know, the thing is funny is, like, once again, it's like back in the day, like you and Coachman were only, you know, you're part of the show, but you were characters on the show.
Right.
And now, you know, the backstage announcers, they're basically just nameless, faceless microphone holders.
I know.
Because you would see Hermie and then Coachman would take shit all the time. And obviously Coachman actually ended up as the general manager, the hell he did. But
right.
What are some of the other memorable backstage interviews that you did?
Oh, gosh. Did a lot of stuff like with Taker and Kane, and you know, I did some offsite stuff. I interviewed you, a few times, and it was always. And Vince had a big thing about, you know, the announcer can't be taller than anybody else. So everybody that I interviewed, I always took my shoes off.
Tall guy.
Yeah, I took my shoes off, and I had the real wide leg spread, and I would try to be in the background as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah. They still have it now. The Tom Phillips leg spread, where he's like basically like his balls are touching the ground, his legs are spread so far.
And you know, we did, we just did a lot of cool stuff. And the crew that would shoot these pre-tapes, you know, I would just try to make them laugh, try to make them. Was this good? What'd you think? Oh, that was really good. You know, or I don't know, maybe.
Right.
They were all, when they were live, they were one take, and that was it. So we always had a blast.
Did you ever have any problems with the live?
No. The only thing I ever had problems with live was when I went to Pillman's house.
Oh.
I went blank. Okay. I got into the moment. So we got there early in the day.
Is this when there was an attack with the gun or something? Or Steve came in his house?
Steve had put Pillman on the shelf.
Right.
And he was going to pursue him, continue at his home. So Pillman pulls out a gun and says, if he shows up, well, I got the answer. So Steve does show up. There's chaos outside. Lights go off. Bang, bang. Jesus.
Right.
Commercial break. Then they go to me because now we have no light because the power's out. And I couldn't come up with the word gunshot. So I was stammering, stuttering for the word, and I said explosions. Mm-hmm. So it was like the only time I ever had problems in life. I just blanked. I couldn't think of the word. And so, of course, I go back to Stanford, and the boys in master control in the tape room, oh, they had their fun with that. They had, they still, you know, me screaming, call the police, and the explosions.
What an angle for the time, though. Even now, like, you could never do that now.
And we got in trouble.
Oh, really?
We got in trouble with USA.
Oh, no, with the network?
Yeah, because we didn't smarten them up. We didn't tell them there's going to be a gun. So they were like, what the hell? Mm. And, you know, oh, it was a starter's pistol. No, it wasn't. It was a Glock. Yeah. But, yeah, when we finished it, it was like, oh, my God, we just did something amazing. This was so fantastic. And then the next day it was like, well, I didn't get in trouble, but, you know.
The company, yeah. Vince, basically.
They got chewed out a little bit.
But there was a lot of those type of angles. I remember, like, there was some really cool stuff, like with Sean. One time where he got beat up and he was like thrown through the windshield of a car. It almost looked like he was dead.
Yeah.
And I was like, you could go in that direction. I was almost wondering, like, a character gets killed off on the show. That's almost the direction it was going into. You know, like CSI or something like that, right. Where you're a regular, like, you know, Game of Thrones, you're a regular, and then suddenly your character dies and you're gone. Like, something that had never been seen in wrestling before.
I think that that was, we got in a lot of trouble with the thing you did with China. Remember
when
you had her,
do tell. I kidnapped her. Kidnapped her.
Yeah.
Just so the backstory was that she always wore gloves. And I was trying to think of something to do with her because she wasn't great, but she tried and she was up for anything. And for whatever reason, Vince had us feuding for like 3 months. And what do you do? Girl versus guy. So I thought, well, what if I kidnap her and smash her fingers with a hammer?
Right.
Where she would have like her glove there and it'd be like filled with like a rag, like sausages in the finger things. And I actually smashed her thumb with a hammer. Good Lord.
Bad person you.
So tell me about that.
So the next day it was a, you know, series of phone calls and emails, but I heard about them after the fact. And that USA was not happy with it. Violence towards women. Internationally, oh my gosh, Chris. International, Tommy Carlucci. Do you know, remember Tommy? Tommy, heavyset Italian guy, been with the company for 1,000 years.
What did he do? Remember the name.
In charge of international production.
Okay, yeah.
And he and his wife, Michelle, both worked there. Anyway, poor Tommy would get these calls every week from Sky TV or whatever. About the show and would have to re-edit.
Wow.
And, oh my gosh. And it was the worst for him. But that one I remember with you in China was like way up there on the, ooh, we probably shouldn't have gone there list because we got in trouble.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Think about that, man. That's terrible. And I remember.
It was just a thumb.
Just a torture situation.
Yeah.
Because I remember like I had an idea of how I would kidnap her. And Vince was like, no, she'll just be in a room. Like, we don't need to see how you kidnapped her. You just have her in the room. I'm like, okay. So I have her tied up like in a chair, smashing her thumb with a hammer. That's terrible.
You're a rotten guy.
Oh, so rotten, man. So rotten.
What are you having fun with all of this? You just look like you're on top of the world right now. You just look like you're killing it with the band.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how do you do it? I asked Tanahashi, like, you know, do you ever get tired and it's a rib, you know? And he always says, I never get tired. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you do this? Is it just like, because it's amazing.
It's just ingrained into your system. Like, you know, I started doing this when I was 19 years old, being on the roads. So that's just what you do. You know, and then the more success you have, the more chances that you take, which leads to more success in other places. And it kind of is very, like talking about The Rock. I mean, once you start getting that confidence, you'll try anything.
Yeah.
And chances are it's going to work because you know what it takes to make it work.
Yeah.
You know, and working for Vince and getting that work ethic, because as you know, when you work in WWE, you're expected to basically be on call
right
24/7.
I've been married to my wife as long as I've been in the business.
Yeah.
And she does not still to this day. She kind of understands it. So 25, 26 years now. No, honey, this is what we do.
Yeah.
This is our life.
Yeah.
And this is the life that we chose because when we were kids, we decided that we wanted to be in the circus.
Mm-hmm.
And so we travel all over the world and we do no sleep and we just go.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you're right.
It's just great.
So what led to you leaving WWE or getting dismissed?
Well, they called me into the office one day and they said, don't come back tomorrow. No, it was just budget cuts.
Oh.
And they just started going department by department. The same day I got let go, like 10 other people in other departments got let go, an accountant and an HR person. And it was just the numbers game.
It's a big, giant corporation with hundreds of employees.
Right.
And like any corporation, it just happens.
It just happens.
Yeah.
And there were no bitter feelings. They gave me a nice severance package on my way out the door. and we parted well, and that was it.
But it's interesting. So we're talking, you mentioned Tanahashi because we're here in Tokyo talking about New Japan, and now you're the commentator here for New Japan World with Don Callis. But before that, it was with
Steve Corino.
Steve Corino. First of all, talk about how this company is growing, New Japan. Wow. And that's exciting to be a part of it, because you can see the buzz and you can see that momentum moving, not just in this country, but around the world.
Yeah, it's amazing. When I started October 2015, the King of Pro Wrestling event. And
for New Japan World?
New Japan World.
That was like the early days of the streaming service?
Yes.
Yeah.
They had just started Let's Have English Commentary as well. Okay, great. Matt Stryker and I did that show, and then they brought Corino on starting in 2016.
How did you get the gig with New Japan?
Through ROH.
Oh, because you're doing Ring of Honor. Gotcha.
Yeah, and the partnership with Ring of Honor in New Japan. And that was how they brought me in. But the house was full, almost full, but it wasn't quite sold out. And we go to Tokyo Dome, and the house is good, but it's got some room for improvement. You can see it. Everything's trending up. And now we're on the doorstep of, what, over 40,000 paid?
It's possible to get there. It could be the biggest Tokyo Dome crowd in like the last 15 years from what I've
heard.
When
Gato started in 2007, mm-hmm. paid crowd was listed at 8,000.
For the Tokyo Dome?
For the Tokyo Dome.
You're kidding me.
No, for Wrestle Kingdom.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that was the first one, 2008. 8,000.
8,000 paid. And then the reported number last year is 26. Mm-hmm. So from 8 to 26 in 10 years. Last year, the floor didn't sell out until December. This year, the floor sold out in October.
Hmm.
So everything's kind of 2 months ahead.
Why is that, do you think?
Because Naito has connected with the audience, and the LIJ thing has taken off, and they have a pillar of four on the top, which is unprecedented.
How do you mean? Like,
meaning the top four now is Okada, Tanahashi, Naito, and Omega.
Right.
And that's the dream scenario for any booker. You want that. And, you know, I liken it to having The Rock, Stone Cold Steve Austin, Randy Savage, and Ric Flair, like, all in their prime. Mm-hmm. And you just, you know, when you throw Hulk Hogan in that mix, when you throw Randy Savage in that mix, The Rock, Stone Cold Steve Austin, nobody ever had that before in their prime. But that's what New Japan has. Mm-hmm. And everybody underneath is clicking as well. And everything is just smart. Booking smart. It's easy. It's easy to digest and understand. They've de-emphasized a lot of the villainry other than Suzuki-gun. So Chaos used to be this really nefarious faction, but now everybody plays it pretty straight. Mm-hmm. They bend the rules, but they don't necessarily break them. And they don't try to get a lot of heat. That's why when you came in, whoa, hey, man,
right.
This is different and shocking. But out of that, they built a lot of stars. And the departures of AJ and Nakamura and Gallows and Anderson didn't hurt, because there was a bench and there were people ready to step up.
Thankfully it was, because that's a big group of guys to lose.
Right.
You know, because people don't realize, maybe if they don't watch New Japan, like, even Gallows and Anderson were a big part of New Japan as the foreign guys. And along with, of course, AJ and Shinsuke, you know, it was a big deal for those guys to go.
Right. So, but again, I thought about it like when Brett left WWE, it was not going to be the end of the world like everybody predicted, that there would be people to step up. And business eventually did go up.
You're forced to find someone to step up.
Right. And that's what happened. So
had Brett not left, Austin might have not have grown to where he did.
Absolutely not. Yeah. And if AJ hadn't left, Omega wouldn't be where
Great
he was.
Point.
He wouldn't have had the 2017 that he did.
Right.
So, it's just wonderful to be able to see there and to be able to do it with Don, and to bring forth, you know, because we're rooted in professional wrestling. That's what we do. That's what we are. And we call the shows in sort of an old school way, but we put a new school spin on everything that we do. And I try to be very factually driven, make sure that I'm telling these guys stories, because there's always new people tuning in. And the audience just continues to grow.
It's interesting how you said that you learned from Jim, from JR, about making the match before they even step into the ring, or as they're circling the ring. But that's two, like, for example, in WWE, that's two Americans. Here you are with two Japanese, but you have to sell that to an American audience. Is there something different that you have to do for that?
I try to liken it. I try to keep it the same. Mm-hmm. I try not to differentiate, because it's not, because there is no language barrier with wrestling. It's universal. And while I may not understand what they're saying in post-match promos, I can understand the emotion. I understand why Hirooki Goto is pursuing Minoru Suzuki and why Suzuki is blowing him off and why Goto is pushed to the point where he'll even put up his own hair to get another match with Suzuki. So all of that just comes through the body language, the facial expressions, and everything. I get it, and I just try to translate it as best I can to the guy. Here's what happened. Here's what's brought us to the now, and we'll see what happens when these two collide.
When you first came to Japan for New Japan, had you been here before?
I had not.
So how's that for you as a culture shock? Because you spent a lot of time here now.
Yeah, it was great. As soon as I got here, I loved it. Mm-hmm. I felt very comfortable, very relaxed. They treat us first class. And just enjoying Japan and the society. I wish America was more like Japan because everybody is so nice and polite and there's courtesy. But I realized after the first show that I didn't know what I didn't know until I knew I didn't know it. And I was out there live and it's like, ooh, I'm not doing a very good job. So I really needed to dig in and know and learn, commit to memory the history of everybody in the ring and their backstory and the company's backstory and being able to recite that, chapter and verse, no matter when. So if somebody grabs a side headlock and they get shoved off in the ropes, I've got time for one line before the tackle. And I can chime in the fact that, you know, Nagata represented the country of Japan in the World Championships as he hits the tackle. And so-and-so was, you know, Kitamura was 120 kilogram champion from the All Japan Championships, whatever. So whatever their backstory is, try to find those lines. But I needed to know them so I'm not reading off of paper. I just had to be able to recite it.
Another thing too, when you're talking, we talked earlier about how if you have to, you know, read something off of a piece of paper as a talent, and Vince being in your ear as a commentator, a lot of the commentating is the same. The one thing I noticed for you and Don, just watching the angle back from Fukuoka where I attacked Omega, there's a lot of excitement.
Right.
And it's not yelling, but I can hear Vince going, don't yell. But meanwhile, you watch any sport, any football, it's a goal.
Right.
He's going in overtime. What a goal. Vince doesn't like that, but it's real emotion.
It's the way that the people at home are reacting, and I'm the voice of the people. We're the chorus in the Greek tragedy. That's what we are. So there's times where we yell, and there's times where we're quiet, and all of those range of movement. If we're screaming the entire time, then it's no good.
Sure. You
can't be at a 10 the whole time. So we try to meter and pace ourselves. But yeah, I get caught up in the moment. And I may not, if WWE called, you know, whatever, they might not want me doing that. But it would be, I'm sorry.
Do you get any instruction at all from Gato or the television people? Or
none from the television people at all. Occasionally I'll go to Gato and I'll just ask, you know, hey, is there anything? And most of the time, no. So we produce ourselves. Nobody tells us when to start. Nobody tells us when to finish. But I have watched. But the shows are produced the same way every time. So I know when we should start. And I know when we should finish. And I know as they get through the curtain, that music is going to drop out. And that's where we need to wrap up our thought. And then there's a little bit of quiet. And then the next music starts. And here we go. They threw me a curveball a couple of shows ago. The shows usually begin with Ozaki reading the list of matches that fans are going to see.
Is he the ring announcer?
He's a ring announcer. So Ozaki is not standing in the ring. And I'm thinking, is he going to do it on the floor? Nope. Music starts. Here we go. Oh,
welcome. Yeah.
We're live, pal.
Yeah.
And so we just reacted to it.
It's so interesting because the company is so huge. But even the other day, like I was watching the show backstage and I was hiding in Fukuoka and Gato was in there. And we're watching Marty Scurll's match, whatever he was with, I think Cody and whoever else he was in there with. And he threw powder in his guy's face and then rolled him up. And Gator's like, oh, powder. Whoa. I said, you didn't know that? He goes, no, I just said roll up. I'm like, so no one told you that he's throwing powder? He's like, no, like that would never happen in WWE because you have to like know every little bit. But so as big as this company is, it's still pretty like very loose and wide open it as is. To what you're doing, you know?
Go be creative, man. Yeah. Go do your thing. And that's the why. That's the secret sauce. Just go and create and do. These guys are paid a lot of money to come over here and do their thing.
Right.
And there's a trust factor. We've picked you because we know you're good enough to do it on this level. And so many guys go, oh my God, I'm going to Japan. What do I do? man, just do you.
Yeah.
They've picked you. They want you to come be you.
Right.
Don't try to be something else now. Well, I need to throw other stuff in. No, you don't.
Yeah.
Stop.
Is it weird for you that also, so it's New Japan World, the streaming service, then there's also Access TV.
Right.
That has a completely different, like Jim Ross is the commentator
yes.
there. Is that kind of strange? Like, it seems that these guys should do both.
Well, yeah, it would make sense, but that's not the direction that they want to
gotcha.
Go in. And I've talked with Access about it. They feel that by having Jim and Josh Barnett, that it's great for the casual fan who's tuning in because they know Jim
Everyone
Ross.
Everyone knows Jim Ross, yeah.
And Josh Barnett has the MMA crowd. Mm. So therefore, that's the reason why that team works best for them. So what they do is what they do, and what Don and I do, we always say the only way you can see these events live is through New Japan World. But by all means, please tune in every week to Access to see if you didn't get a chance to see it live or to see something you might miss. But I always encourage everybody.
Because they're really trying to build the streaming service. So like even for, you know, the Alpha versus Omega idea, I was pitching like, dude, you guys got to do a pay-per-view for this. This is worldwide. And like, nope, has to be streaming only, streaming only, streaming only, streaming only. Do you think they have, not a chance, but do you think it's possible that the streaming service will get to the point where there's hundreds of thousands of people watching New Japan live?
I absolutely believe so, because it's the way television is moving.
Hmm.
You know, with cord cutting and with everything like this, just people now are getting into these streaming services. I think New Japan World needs to step up on the technology end. They're a little bit behind. Mm-hmm. It's only available on Amazon Fire Stick. It's not available on Roku. It's not available. Man, they need to get there. Mm-hmm. And once they do, once it's available to everybody on every device that they have, then I think it's going to be, you know, the growth is just there. The more live that we can do, the more events that we can cover. I said I want to do every G1 show next year. Mm. I want to do all 19 of them.
Oh, wow. Okay. Be there for all of them.
Man. We came in, we did the beginning, the first four, and the last three. Mm. Well, it's those 12 in the middle to where that's where I worry that we lose the audience. Mm. But we need to do every show live. And I don't know if technologically or budgetarily whether they're there yet, but that's what I've pitched.
First, you mentioned that it's you and Stryker, and then it's you and Carino, and now it's you and Don Callis. How is that for you? Like, to me, it would almost like being in a band and you're a guitar player and you lose one guitar player and get another one in. Then, like, is there some chemistry that you have to work with? Or do you have any say in who's coming in? Do they just hire somebody to go, here he is, Kevin?
It's you know, I was glad that, when it was Stryker and I, it was fine. We knew each other. When I work with somebody that I don't know, it's a little difficult, but then you get to know them.
You have no choice.
Yeah. And Stryker, I've known for many years. Carino and I did every week on Ring of Honor, so we had our act down pat. Don and I were friends going way back when he was in WWF together, and we had done a couple of shows together for Scott D'Amore.
Oh, way back when. Okay.
I knew that when, because Tiger called me, Hattori called me and said, hey, Carino leaving, so we're going to go with Don Callis. Hmm. I said, oh, great, great. He and I worked together before. Easy, no problem. And I knew when we worked together on those shows, we would be a good team. And this was 2004, I think it was, or 2003. And sure enough, Don was able to pick it all up. You know, a little learning curve for him to kind of get...
Of course, to learn the whole situation.
Figuring out what he's watching.
Who's around, yeah.
Yeah, but, he's gotten it. And now I think we're... You know, I take pride in the fact that people say we're the best... You know, oh, we're the best team in wrestling. That makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And all I care about is that I have the respect of the boys.
Mm.
And that they know that I'm there for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not there for me. I don't have a bunch of T-shirts up on Pro Wrestling Tees. I'm not a catchphrase guy. I'm there to get their catchphrases over, to sell their T-shirts. Because the more money that they make, I know I'll always have a job.
Mm-hmm. Do you go and talk to everybody before? Do you have anything for me? Do you guys come to you?
I totally do that, yes. Even the Japanese, I go to them. Please, anything, tell me. And like Kota Ibushi, he and Kushida were the tag with Skrull and Cody. Kota gave me some things that I used on the air. And I try to do that with everybody. I think it's vitally
important.
You
have to work with your announcers, you know, and your referee and your cameraman. It's a big team out there, and a lot of guys don't realize that, and the best guys do.
Right.
Like, it's not just me versus, you know, Kenny. I need you and Don on board. I need the cameraman to know what's going to happen. I need the referee to know where to be. All of it is working together to create this great show.
Exactly.
You know?
The Japanese announcers are not smartened up to anything.
Really?
They don't know anything. They stay in their room and that's it. And they call what they see.
Hmm.
I'm ahead of them because I know what's to come a lot.
Do you like that, knowing what's to come?
Heck yeah.
Because I know Jim Ross says sometimes he doesn't like even knowing what the finish is. He might just be working it too. Who knows with him, right?
But give me a break. If I don't know the finish, that's fine. I don't care. But if there is something crucial in the match that you want me to get over, please tell me. Chances are I'll see it and I'll pick it up anyway. But why leave it to chance?
You're telling a story.
Yeah.
Here's the story. Yeah.
I'm gonna foreshadow something that might come later.
Mm-hmm.
And then the audience at home goes, oh, yes, he told us that was coming. You know, I like to leave clues if possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then it helps with the narrative.
What was the biggest culture shock for you when you first came over here?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it was they don't serve drinks like when you eat. And that's like, I'm a big, hey, free refills for Coke? Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. Let me get another Diet. Oh, wait, no Diet Coke? Oh, Coke Zero. And the whole driving on the wrong side of the road. I remember like being on the bus from the airport the first time. And that was just weird.
Hmm.
I had never been to the UK. I had never been. Hmm. I'd only traveled to Canada, Puerto Rico, and all over the United States.
Hmm.
So seeing that and being in a vehicle that where the driver's on the wrong side of the road was like weird. And then I go out to dinner with somebody and I sit in the front seat where the driver's wheel, yeah. And I'm, wait, what's going on?
How about the taxi drivers with the white gloves? Oh, I like that.
So amazing.
Look like chauffeurs.
Yeah. And just walking around, it's going, there's no garbage cans, but everything is so clean. How do they do this?
Little stuff.
But now just having gotten into it, learning more about the history of Japan, going on castle tours with War Machine, and Ray Rowe is such a big history buff that like he knows why this castle was built the way it was in the 9th century. It's just so cool. It's so, so different.
Yeah, I mean, it is a whole different world over here, but it's still very Americanized. But when you get into the real Japan, it's pretty cool.
You go to some of these country towns and
yeah.
It's wait, what? But Tokyo is like New York.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, completely. Very Americanized. Yeah.
Don and I went, when we were in Sapporo last year, we were in Hokkaido for the January show. So it was Don's first time. We went out to eat afterward, and we're trying to find, okay, where can we go? Oh, there's a place across the street. It has two American names. They made no sense together. Contextually, it didn't work. But let's go in there. They probably serve food. We walk in, and they go, Japanese only. Oh, no problem. No. Japanese only, waving, pointing at us.
Wow.
Get out. Okay. And there was an old guy sitting at the door. We didn't see him on the way in. Spoke perfect English. You need a ride? You need to go somewhere? No, we're fine. We'll walk. What the hell was that? But the boys said, yeah, sometimes you go to different places.
It's very racist is what, that's racism.
It is
racism. You know, it's like we would go to places and there'd be sign on the wall, like it's a buffet. And it used to happen all the time. No wrestlers or sumo allowed.
Wow.
And then, because they just won't let you in. So, like, are you wrestling? No. Dame. The dame is like strong, no. Like, absolutely not. It's like, you can't do that.
Right.
Well, yes, you can. Japanese only. You're like, really? Is that what it is?
So, but other than that, they've been just great.
Is it hard not to be working in the States? Just have completely working over here? Or are you fine with that now?
I'm fine with it. I'm doing.
You left Ring of Honor on your own accord, right?
I did. Back in June. And it was just time, because schedules, I couldn't make a match up. But. I do a little bit of stuff here and there. Like I've been doing like camps with the Monster Factory in New Jersey and with Mercury Pro Wrestling, but I've had a chance to do some shows like in Quebec City, and I just did WrestleCade, which was a lot of fun. In Quebec, I did a camp where I talked to all native French speakers about doing promos. But again, it worked.
Yeah.
Because it was about facial expressions and no words.
Right.
Don't speak. Mm-hmm. Say nothing. But make me feel. And, WrestleCade was fun because I saw a lot of old friends and, called 3 days worth of matches. Mm-hmm. But I've been doing a little bit of stuff here and there. But by and large, it's mostly been coaching at different seminars and then... And then traveling over here.
Last couple of questions. What was your favorite thing that you did in WWE? Is there a certain interview that you had or a moment or a match that you saw?
Getting to chase The Undertaker and Kane, because I pitched the idea.
Chase them how?
The Undertaker or Kane and Paul Bearer said that they were going to dig up their dead parents and bring them to the arena. So I go to the gravesite. And the Undertaker is there, and I interview him, and he grabs me, shoves me down, and then goes and realizes the burial plots are empty. And we haul ass back to the building, and by then now Kane and pallbearer had brought these caskets out, and they open them, and there's mice running through them, and these skeletons. It was so hokey. But that was one of my ideas. And then when Stephanie and Triple H got married, because I pitched that.
Really?
Yeah, my wife and I were talking, we're big soap opera buffs, and we came up with the idea together that Triple H should somehow con Stephanie into marrying him. So I write this whole big email up, and I send it in, and I send it to Vince and to Shane and Stephanie and Kevin Dunn and Jim Ross, and Vince was the first one to respond like 5 minutes later, and all caps, "That's great shit." And Shane comes down the hall, and he pokes his head at my office. He goes, "Dude, that's sick. I love it." And that's, they changed it to,
she drugged her or something. Yeah, in Vegas. Yeah.
It was but the idea was that he was going to be the one to be married to instead of Portest.
Yeah.
So that was always fun. And just any time I got to do anything and to see another memory too. And I talk about the production staff in WWF all the time. So we go to the Houston Astrodome, 70,000 people. And
WrestleMania 17.
Yeah, the truck was inside the dome. It was that big. And two of the people that worked in the truck, Kasama, you may remember Kasama Vasatiti, and Ann Clampett, who's not there anymore, they came out and they stood and they on the steps of the truck and they looked out to all the people and they were like arm in arm. They were so excited that they were a part of this. Like, I remember that and never will forget that even these, you know, young women who probably never would have dreamed that they would work in wrestling would be here in front of 70,000 people and were playing an instrumental role in everything.
Part making it happen, last question, as far as New Japan goes, who are the best performers in the company? You mentioned the top four, but who are your favorites to call?
Well, I've enjoyed seeing Evil and Sonata take the next step. I think Sonata has every athletic tool that a wrestler could want and then some. And it's just a question of seeing him break out. Evil is already getting there. I think they're great. I'm such a fan of Juice Robinson. I think he's got a tremendous ceiling. And when you get to see Tomohiro Ishii come out there as the Stone Pit Bull and look just miserable, and then when he's in a lot of trouble, oh man, I feel it. And it's just wonderful. And from the rise of the Young Lions, the kids that are on their way up, and to see how hard they work and to how much effort they put into their little spot they get and their opportunity. I take something from every show and I smile, but just to see Cody and what he's doing, you know, and the appreciation that
Groove
he has
so much. It's amazing to see
incredible
him. Do you think that this product can make that mainstream jump into the States?
I absolutely think, because the things that we talked about with WWE are the reasons why there is a vast audience that is available to New Japan. It's not that WWE is doing anything wrong. They're making more money than ever before, and that's their business model. So it's working for them. But there are a bunch of people who are not watching what? You know, the 7 million people, Mark Madden and I talk about, the 7 million people that used to watch on Monday nights, where did they go? Were they taken in a rapture? Was it an alien abduction? No, they're there. They're just not being talked to. And I think that the New Japan product, the way it's constructed now, speaks to everybody. And I know there's a vast audience out there that all they need to do is see it once, and they're going to be hooked. And that's what we're trying to do. We're building a legion of fans, one fan at a time. And I'm doing a lot of outreach, and I love talking with folks on social media and all the people that have been fans of New Japan for years and years and years that now are seeing the product rise again, because business was so bad. It looked like it was going to go out of business for a while. And now this renaissance has just been remarkable. But to be able to be a part of this in my small way has just been, it's one of the greatest joys of my life.
Well, man, it's good to see you here, and it's cool to hear you and Don do your thing, and you've come a long way from Hermie.
Thank you, Chris.
How do you say Hermie in Japanese?
Hermie-san.
All right, thanks to Kevin Kelly. Hermie, I love that story. He's tearing it up as an announcer at New Japan Pro Wrestling. You can follow him on Twitter, at RealKevinKelly, and hear him on New Japan World every single week, basically. Thanks to everyone who came to rock with Fozzy in New Zealand and Australia. What a great tour it was. Great to reestablish ourselves in the market after 5 long years. I promise, Australia, we won't be, it won't be 5 years before we come back again. I'll tell you that right now. So, great shows. Melbourne was amazing. Auckland was crazy, too. Great country.
country over there. Speaking of great countries, heading to the homeland for the last leg of the Judas Rising tour. We started in May 2017. Here we are going to finish off December of 2018. And we start in Moncton at the Casino New Brunswick on November 21st. November 23rd, Halifax at the Canard Center. 24th, Quebec City at Center of Videotron. 25th, Montreal at MTELUS. And the 26th, Arnprior, Ontario at the St. John. That is sold out. Thank you for that. London, Ontario at the London Music Hall on the 27th of November. Toronto, returning to Toronto, November 28th at the Rock Pile. Come check that out. November 30th, Thunder Bay at Crocs. Winnipeg, hometown show at the Burton Cummings Theater on December 1st. December 2nd, Regina at the Exchange. That's sold out. It's going to be a great show. The 3rd in Edmonton at the Starlight Room. And the 4th, Calgary, Alberta at the Gateway. The final show of the Judas Rising Tour, and what a tour it's been. FozzyRock.com for all ticket information and how to get tickets for Fozzy's legendary VIP meet and greets. We do everything. We meet you, we greet you, we hang out with you. We do a private concert just for you. Last night in Adelaide, we did Judas, Drink with Jesus, To Kill a Stranger, Free Will Burning, and Cold Gin. That's just a sample of what you're going to hear. Some songs that you're not going to hear anywhere else except for at VIP. So come check it out. Hang out with us. Go to Fozzy Rock on Instagram and check out our story. You'll see it every night, how much fun we have at VIP. FozzyRock.com. Come see us, Canada. It's going to be a blast. Speaking of blast, like I said, coming up on Friday, the best worst Survivor Series preview ever. Jack Slade returns to go match by match to the card, a changing card. Lots of stuff happening just basically over the last couple of nights. So it's going to be a must here if you want to check out Survivor Series. This will be a preview to take you through it. Then you can go to WWENetwork.com/Jericho and watch Survivor Series for free. All right. Have a good time all the time. We'll see you on Friday. Be cool. Stay hard. Stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!